Our opening words today are based on those of Marianne Hackton Cotter. Welcome to this place of possibility. This is love's hearth, the home of hope, a refuge for minds in search of truth, unfolding ever beautiful and ever strange. Here, compassion is our shelter, freedom our protection and from the storms of bigotry and hate. In this abode, may we find comfort and courage. Here, may our sight become vision, to see the unseen, to glimpse the good that is yet to be, and to find and build happiness wherever we go. Do I have a child here to help me light the chalice? Blessed is the fire that burns deep in the soul. It is the fire of love burning deep in the human heart. Please stand in body or spirit and join us in singing our first hymn, number 331, Life is the Greatest Gift of All, verses 1 and 2. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Erin Johnston, and I'm the worship artist service representative for this morning's service. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in the social hall after the service, and while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Please take a moment at this point in the service to silence all your electronics that you may have here with you today. And again, welcome to all here this morning. We are now going to share the story for all ages. And before we start that, one of the ways that we care for the wider community is by contributing to local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward at this point in the service and put them in that basket, or you can ask a child to bring them forward for you. And now I would like to invite all the children, young and children young at heart, to come forward up front and enjoy a story.
for a moment of technical difficulty.
Okay, this is a story that I found on the LCUUC Story for All Ages webpage, and it's called Thankful Dogs, and it's by Naomi King. And towards the end, I'm going to need some help from everybody in the congregation. Once there was, and once there was not, a family of dogs. And like many dog families, and like many families, there were dogs that had wandered off the street in the houses. There were dogs that had really fine pedigrees. There were dogs from shelters. And there were also dogs that had been born into their special family. All of these dogs played together. They tumbled together. And they rolled around in great masses of tails and snouts and paws. And they all loved each other very, very much. Sometimes they growled at each other. And sometimes they worried. They didn't know if there were going to be enough biscuits in the cupboards for them. Sometimes they didn't feel very happy, and they didn't wag their tails very much. And sometimes they even snapped at another dog. But in spite of all of their doggy moods, they loved each other very, very much. And every night, as the moon rose, the family of dogs went outside. And they sat in a great big circle on the soft grass. Or if it was winter in Wisconsin, they sat in the snow. Or they might have sat in the ice. And they would watch the moon. I guess it rises over there. Rise! And they would look into each other's eyes. And then they would wag their tails. Because that was a doggy thing to do. Well, when the moon was a dog's tail, about this high, above the horizon, the eldest dog would howl loudly at the moon. And this is where I need your help, because I need to remember what a howl sounds like. Does it sound like this? Does that sound like a dog howl? So the eldest dog, what he was doing was telling the other dogs about the moon. And telling the whole world what she was thankful for. She did this while she was howling. Thank you for this day. Thank you for all the running and jumping I get to do. Thank you for the biscuits and the treats. Can you help me? Thank you for my little doggy friends. And thank you for my human friends who are always throwing me a ball. And thank you for being able to sing. Oh, thank you for everything! And then the youngest dog, which was really a puppy, would point her nose to the moon and then she would begin to howl. Thank you for the wonderful sun that has warmed my back. Thank you for the pack of dogs that do all their wiggly dances. Thank you for the ice cream truck with the bells that ring and bring treats. Thank you for this, and thank you for all my luck. And then one after another, and this is where I really, really need your help. The dogs would join the howling, saying their thanks until they were all singing to the moon together. They did this no matter what the weather was. No matter how many of them were there or how few of them were there. Every night they would greet the moon. So I would like to ask the children and the adults to share. I'm going to say in English what we're thankful for, and then we're all going to thank in doggy talk. Thank you, Mother. Thank you, Father. Thank you for my sisters and thank you for my brothers. Oh, thank you, neighbor, and thank you, friend. Oh, thank you, strangers who came here today. Thank you, everybody in the world. We give thanks for every being, whether near or far, and we give thanks for all those we hold deep in our hearts. And our last thanks is our loudest thanks. Come on! Okay, and now I'd like to ask one of the children to take the light, and we're going to sing the children off to RE. We have been warmed by the fires we did not build. We have drunk at the wells we did not dig. We acknowledge not only our blessings, but also our many needs. This community exists because we sustain it. The gifts of the congregation will now be gratefully received. As noted in our order of service, this is a time when we invite all to share their joys or concerns with the congregation. If you choose to share, please raise your hand, and when the usher brings you a microphone, please briefly tell us your name and the concern or joy which you wish to share. And I will light a candle at that point to represent your joy or concern. And in this sharing, may our sorrows be lightened and our joys multiplied.
This is Harold. I want to light a candle of joy to celebrate an event that occurred on this date in 1951, which is 62 years, in case your math module isn't turned on. But anyway, at that time in metropolitan Chicago, there were 3 feet of snow on the ground. But nevertheless, I was able to marry a lovely young woman who was sitting next to me today. And after that, we proceeded to my first assignment as a naval officer with my, and we drove away to the New York Naval Shipyard with a quick stop in New Orleans in my 1938 Chevrolet.
Angel, 7 years ago on December 18th was Sam's accident, and she's at this point grateful for it and doing well. The big news is she, just this last week, was able to sit up from a laying down position without using her arms at all, which I don't think most of us can do, quite frankly. But she's doing it, and she's strong, and I think that all of us are finally able to move on from it and heal and forgive and move forward. So, good news from the Sammy front. Thanks. Bye.
This is Lynn. Yesterday, December 28th, 1953, Phil was born, so he turned 60 yesterday, and so I'm really thankful that he was born, and he's been a wonderful husband and wonderful father. Yeah, so lots to celebrate.
I'm Julie Carell.
Maybe. Can anybody hear?
Yep. Okay, good. A candle of for Uncle John, just saying the whole family. He passed away on the 23rd, and everybody's not traveling to come up to celebrate and remember him, and hopefully remember the good more so than the cancer over the last 2 years. So.
One last candle for the joys and concerns that we hold privately in our hearts.
Good morning. The first reading is from Anne Frank. The best remedy for those who are afraid, lonely, or unhappy is to go outside, somewhere where they can be quite alone with the heavens, nature, and God, because only then does one feel that all is as it should be, and that God wishes to see people happy amidst the simple beauty of nature. As long as this exists, and it certainly always will, I know that then there will always be comfort for every sorrow, whatever the circumstances may be. And I firmly believe that nature brings solace in all troubles. I'm going to invite you to do a meditation, a period of silence this morning. And I was originally going to ask you to think about the times that happiness has visited you spontaneously in your life, and you can certainly do that. But after hearing the story, I decided I'd tell you a little story and let you meditate on the meaning of that if you wish to. You've probably heard this story, but it's a good one. It's about a Native American grandfather and his grandson. And his grandson was very troubled at one point in his life and didn't know which way to go or who he was, you know, that sort of identity crisis that all of us go through at some point or another, and sometimes repeatedly. And he went to his grandfather and he said, "Grandfather, I feel torn inside. I feel like there's this war going on inside of me between two parts of me, and I just don't know what to do about it. Have you ever had that experience?" And the grandfather thought about it for a minute, and he said, "Yeah, I have, actually." He said, "To me, it's like inside of me there are these two dogs. And one of them is kind of an angry dog. You know, you go up to it, it snarls, and it looks mean, like it might bite you. And it's kind of nasty. And the other dog, well, it's kind of a happy dog. It's the kind when you go up to it, it's tail's wagging and it's looking like it's glad to see you and happy to be there. But the thing is, they sort of go at it each other sometimes. They kind of have a fight. And the grandson thought about it for a minute. He goes, "Well, grandfather, which one of them wins?" And the grandfather said, "The one I feed the most." So let's think about that for a moment. Let's meditate on that. For second reading, I actually have two. The first is from the Dalai Lama, who was just in Madison this past summer, I believe, who said, "I believe compassion to be one of the few things we can practice that will bring immediate and long-term happiness to our lives. I'm not talking about the short-term gratification of pleasures like sex, drugs, or gambling, though I'm not knocking them, but something that will bring true and lasting happiness, the kind that sticks, and that's compassion." And the second is from John Lennon. We've heard some of his music this morning. "When I was 5 years old, my mother always told me that happiness was the key to life. When I went to school, they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wrote down, happy. They told me I didn't understand the assignment. And I told them they didn't understand life."
Please stand in body or spirit and join in singing the centering hymn, number 123, Spirit of Life.
Thank you for being here this morning. If I sound a little hoarse, it's because I'm recovering from whatever it is that we're all recovering from. Went to my doctor on Friday, and I don't usually go to doctors, but went to him, and he said, "Yeah, you'll have this cough for another 3 or 4 weeks, so just get used to it." I said, thanks. How much do I owe you? Anyway, about happiness. Up until around the year 2000, for every study done on happiness, there were 100 conducted on mood disorders and psychopathology. Meaning until recently, we knew a lot more about how to make people miserable than about how to make them happy. Since then, a movement called positive psychology has promoted considerable research focused on one primary question. What is the secret sauce for living a fulfilled life? Well, surveys by the National Science Foundation suggest that most of us don't have the recipe for that secret sauce. Since 1972, they've done these yearly surveys, and only about one-third of Americans have described themselves as, quote, truly happy. Also, since about 2004, the number of Americans who describe themselves as optimists, an attitude that's generally correlated with happiness, is down from 79% to just under 50%. Meanwhile, the incidence of mental maladies has increased, with depression and anxiety topping the list, which comes as no surprise to any of us. This has led to an entire happiness industry, if you will, that ranges from using antidepressants, which accounts for about 25% of women and 5% of men, to self-improvement products and services, on which we spend about $10 billion a year, and a bench of over 5,000 professional motivational speakers and tens of thousands of life coaches. But so far, this industry has yet to deliver. The 2012 World Happiness Report puts the United States in 23rd place out of 50 nations surveyed. Iceland, New Zealand, and Denmark take the gold, silver, and bronze, respectively, in this category. Notably, these nations, along with several others in Europe, now measure national success not just on the basis of gross domestic product, or GDP, but also by assessing the overall well-being of their populations, which they now regularly survey. I recently heard a member of the House of Lords from Great Britain talking about the fact that this has now become a primary focus of discussion in Parliament about not how to just raise the GDP, but how to raise the well-being index of the population of Great Britain. That's not a dialogue we're having very much of in this country. Now, the term happiness is somewhat misleading. By definition, if you look it up, happiness means, quote, feeling or showing pleasure or contentment. But the behavioral science research indicates that pleasure is not, in fact, central to happiness, and more often than not, can even interfere with our efforts to achieve it. What's more, while being happy can create a sense of contentment, or life satisfaction, as we call it, that is more of an end than a means. So happiness is not the same as pleasure, but often includes a sense of contentment. In other words, this definition is not very helpful. It fails to answer a core question. How is it that people attain happiness? Well, let's start by looking at a few of the research findings about what does not make people happy, because that informs the other side, what does. Contrary to the current value orientation in America, materialism and consumerism are largely toxic to individual, familial, and collective happiness. Of course, you never know that by observing human behavior, because most of us are engaged at some level with trying to achieve happiness by buying and owning stuff. For example, every year we shell out $200 billion for electric gadgets alone, a lot of those recently, yet increased e-time, as it's called, is actually inversely correlated with happiness. The more time you spend on these devices, the less happy you are. It only requires an hour or so of watching TV advertisements, which is an onerous experience in its own right, to realize that most products and services are being sold as ingredients for growing happiness. Whether it's smartphones, deodorant, cars, mega burgers, fashion, hair care products, whatever, the value proposition is always the same. The basic message is, if you use or have this, you'll be happier. But it just ain't so. So, what about wealth and happiness? Well, unless a person lives in poverty or is affluent but spends more money on experiences than on things, there's an inverse relationship between wealth and life satisfaction. Once a person's basic needs are met, shelter, food, clothing, health care, and other necessities, piling on more affluence does not move the happiness needle to any degree. In fact, research indicates that often greater wealth erodes life satisfaction. And there are times when it does not, sure. Yet those who use their wealth to help others and have engaging life experiences can feel greater happiness as a result of that affluence. But those who use it to buy stuff, pile on pleasure, or exercise power over others experience the opposite effect. Why? Because the pursuit of money and stuff is a powerful predictor that one will spend less time in intimate relationships, giving to others and feeling a part of a greater purpose, and more time doing compulsory activity, being a servant to one's possessions. In other words, we don't own stuff, it owns us. Anybody who owns a house understands this. Now, people generally confuse pleasure with happiness, and as I've noted, our consumer-based economy depends on this confusion and actively promotes it. It attempts to convince us that if we acquire certain objects, attain a certain lifestyle, indulge in certain pleasures, and conform to specific social standards of attractiveness, for example, all of which are related to what many commercial interests wish to sell us, we'll be happier. What research shows is that while these goodies may bring us temporary pleasure, this does not translate into sustained life satisfaction. As G.K. Chesterton said, quote, there are two ways to get enough. One is to continue to accumulate more and more. The other is to desire less and less. The reason why pleasure and happiness are not highly correlated is because of something that psychologists call the hedonic treadmill. Now, psychologists are always making up these kind of terms because that's what keeps us in business. Simply stated, our brains rapidly habituate in response to repeated exposure to pleasurable stimuli and experiences, with a couple of exceptions. Whatever the focus of the pleasure, food, drugs, sex, gambling, whatever, once the brain has sufficient exposure to the pleasurable stimuli of the moment, it quickly morphs away from wow to been there, done that. The result is that one must either continually ramp up the intensity of pleasurable experiences, or one must repeatedly find new and different pleasures. Either strategy may prolong pleasure for a time, but it will not lead to sustained happiness. Now, there are a few exceptions to the pleasure doesn't bring happiness rule, which includes, among others, music, reading, nature interaction, and similar low amplitude sources of pleasure. Exposure to these kinds of stimuli can contribute to greater life satisfaction. Now, this habituation process, this getting used to pleasure quickly, has a bright side to it. It allows us to quickly adjust to new life circumstances, including unhappy ones. So, when our lives take a turn for the worse, such as developing a chronic illness, experiencing a divorce, within about a year, most of us will adapt to a new normal and rebound from these negative impacts on mood and behavior. Inversely, the same holds true for seemingly positive developments in our lives, such as maybe winning the lottery, a promotion, a new romance. Again, in about a year, whatever bump we gained in life satisfaction soon levels out. And this whole idea of what goes on in the brain has led to something called the set point theory of happiness, which, as you've probably anticipated, I'm going to explain. This theory, and it's just a theory, holds that each of us has a genetically determined set point that keeps our level of life satisfaction from deviating much higher or lower than the average. Not unlike the so-called set point that you've heard about that's associated with metabolism or weight. This internal governor, if you will, supposedly mediates the impact of both positive and negative events on our overall life satisfaction. So, the theory goes, a person who becomes paraplegic will, within about a year, return to being just as happy as she or he was before becoming disabled. And a person who wins the lottery will do the same. Some folks take a certain comfort in this theory, assuming that if their degree of happiness is genetically set, why strive to become happier? This could be subsumed under the popular heading of "it is what it is," which is a quote I'm becoming less fond of all the time. But not so fast. Here's the rub in that theory. Recently, we discovered that genes are further from destiny, particularly in life satisfaction, than we originally assumed. This is because of something called epigenetics. That's E-P-I, genetics. Google it, as we say. Basically, we now know that life experiences strongly influence which genes get expressed or repressed and how much. So let's say you have a genetic marker that makes you more susceptible to depression. And there are some, and therefore greater risk of being unhappy in a chronic way. Through frequent exposure to certain life experiences, such as exercise, music, nature interaction, an anti-inflammatory diet, positive social interactions, meditation, you can dampen down the expression of your depression gene, thereby increasing your life satisfaction. So, the set point theory of happiness appears to have some validity, but not as much as we thought. And as an example of that, there was a study done of over 150,000 adults who were followed for over 25 years. That's a long study and a big N, showing that their degree of life satisfaction shifted above or below their happiness set point by, on average, up to 40%, which is a major significant deviation. In terms of how we measure life satisfaction, that's a very wide range in which to operate. So, consider what you think your current level of happiness is. The capacity to, by your actions, increase or decrease that level by up to 40% is not chump change. But the ability to move your happiness bar by, say, 60% or more is no easy task. So, there may be a valid set point for happiness, but through the choices we make, we can change it to a demonstrable and palpable degree. Now, when it comes to increasing our happiness, choices are good, right? It's another thing we tell ourselves in America. The answer is yes and no. The yes is that we can increase our life satisfaction by making certain choices, which I'll specify shortly. The no is that most of us are really bad at figuring out what those choices should be. Dan Gilbert, a Harvard psychologist, has determined through research that most of us are poor predictors of what will make us happy. Fundamentally, we are bad at estimating the outcomes and the durational impact of events as they relate to our happiness. For example, someone might imagine that a new 60-inch plasma TV, salary increase, remodeled kitchen, or a new romantic interest will deliver greater life satisfaction. And anybody who's ever remodeled their kitchen know that that's not true. And almost always that person will be wrong, at least over the long term. If I may interject a cynical antidote, I attended my nephew's wedding recently, and like many such events, everyone was awash in good vibes and busy proclaiming all sorts of predictions about how the newlyweds are going to make each other very happy for many years to come and create wonderful life together. Well, statistics on divorce and its lesser cousin, marital dysfunction, indicate that most often these predictions will either not come to pass or prove to be way overblown. So whatever you are telling yourself about what will make you happy is, over the long run, either wrong or probably exaggerated. Sorry. Feel better? Okay. And now there's a little bit more bad news about choices. I'm going to get to the good stuff in a minute. Research shows that more choices and happiness are not highly correlated. When given too many choices, many of us developed something called paralysis by analysis. which means we have greater difficulty making a decision, let alone the right one. It is within this sort of mental echo chamber called making a decision that we suffer the tug of war over which choice will make us happier, and the more options we have, the more we tend to suffer. So, in combination, we're bad at predicting those choices that lead to greater life satisfaction, and the more we have, the harder it is to make the right one. This pushes against a cultural value in America that tells us that we should pursue happiness and that the ticket in this regard is to have many choices and opportunities in our lives. By making the right decisions, we can be happier, or so we tell ourselves. However, the research indicates this is a flawed assumption. It appears that people are happier when they employ their emotional resilience to accept and make the best of a fixed or limited set of circumstances or choices, rather when they relentlessly pursue the next best thing, situation, or toy. I can tell you about a time I went into a high-end grocery store here in the Milwaukee area, and I went in to get mustard. And I didn't know what kind of mustard I wanted to get. But I just know I wanted mustard. So I went in, I went to the mustard aisle, and I stood there, and there was, I don't know, 30 or 40 different kinds of mustard. And I, of course, stood there for a while in a trance-like state, and then I gave up, sighed, and walked out without any mustard. And the research, in fact, shows that when we have more than 6 or 8 choices without knowing clearly what it is that we want, we will not make a choice. So, just an anecdote there. Finally, there's a popular urban myth to the effect that intelligence and happiness are mutually exclusive. Jonathan Safran Foer, an author, said, "I've thought and thought and thought. I've thought myself out of happiness a million times, but never once into it." Ernest Hemingway, who wasn't exactly an icon of happiness, echoed this sentiment when he stated, quote, "Happiness in intelligent people is the rarest thing I know." This myth, like many, has an element of truth. Highly intelligent people are more likely to use their primary strength, their intellect, to achieve their goals. But if you live almost entirely above your neck, happiness may prove elusive. After all, it is a feeling and an experience, not an idea. Okay, that's enough about what doesn't make us happy. I assume I've gotten you all sufficiently deflated at this point. So what does? Well, in a nutshell, here's what the research tells us we should do. These are not in order of priority. I'll give you that in a moment. Surround ourselves with loving family. Notice I said loving family. And good friends. This creates emotional intimacy. By the way, research indicates, you're not going to like this one, research indicates that a fulfilling marriage without children is a better predictor of happiness than a fulfilling marriage with children. I'm not making this up. This may surprise some of you, but not others. Overall, it is the quality of relationships rather than their prevalence that supports emotional well-being. As George Burns quipped, quote, "Happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city." I don't want to make too much light of it. Happiness and relationships are correlated, provided they're loving, intimate, emotionally intimate relationships. Number two, don't strive to keep up with the Joneses or the culturally imposed yardsticks for a fulfilled life, which in American society are fundamentally wrong. In other words, develop your own yardsticks for what constitutes a successful and fulfilled life. Three, as often as possible, lose your mind and come to your senses. In other words, be here now. Instead of spending a lot of time and energy contemplating one's navel or the meaning of existence, get into the flow of your life, into the flow of living. As noted anthropologist Joseph Campbell stated, I don't think people are seeking the meaning of life. I think they are seeking the experience of being alive. And happy people embrace that. Next, and this is number one of all the factors that influence happiness the most, this is number one, forgive. The research here is abundantly clear. The number one thing we can do to promote happiness in our lives is to forgive those we feel have wronged us. This is a spiritual capacity that allows us to move on in life rather than getting stuck in the muck of resentment and bitterness, which are toxic not only to happiness, but to physical health and mental well-being. In fact, we can show that people who are mired in bitterness have a prolonged and extensive inflammatory response inside their body that affects their overall general well-being, as well as the emotional impacts. Without forgiving, we pile on emotional baggage, and eventually its spiritual weight becomes too great, stopping us from moving ahead in life. The Latin word for baggage is impedimenta, and that's what it is. If you don't forgive, soon your life is impeded by all that emotional stuff. Next, live healthy. This is an interesting one. Happiness is not directly correlated with actually being physically healthy, but it is strongly associated with feeling healthy, the subjective sense that one is well. Nonetheless, people who are truly healthy in an objective sense are more likely to feel well in a subjective sense. So the formula here is simple. Exercise, good nutrition, adequate sleep, less stress, all the stuff your mom told you. But not always simple to implement and maintain. Nonetheless, it's the feeling of wellness rather than an objective measure that makes the difference. Next, clear your mind. Increasingly, research indicates that a cluttered mind is an unhappy one, which is interesting because I always felt that a neat desk was a sign of a deeply disturbed person. But at any rate, information overload, multitasking as we call it, which is a myth, and hurry sickness are the norm today. And these are the primary sources of mental clutter. And hurry sickness, if you need to understand what that is, get out on 94, get in the left lane, and go the speed limit. You'll see hurry sickness in your rearview mirror. The best ways to clear one's mind, research says, are meditation, number one, and nature interaction, number two. Those who meditate and interact mindfully with nature are happier people, and the research bears that out. And finally, live with purpose. Devoting time and energy to something meaningful and greater than oneself is part of the happiness recipe. A purpose-driven life that is not largely self-serving is often a happy one, even when difficult external circumstances come into play. This also links with something we call agency, the belief that one can make a difference in the world, no matter how limited the scope of one's impact. People with agency are the opposite of those who believe they are controlled by external forces, which is the victim mindset. As Hugh Downs, from 2020, reminded us, quote, a happy person is not someone in a certain set of circumstances, but rather someone with a certain set of attitudes. So, is happiness a choice? In limits, it appears to be. Abraham Lincoln said, people are just as happy as they make up their minds to be. And there's an element of truth to that. Granted, if there is a happiness set point, then the choice to be happy is easier for some than for others. Still, there clearly are things we can do to increase our sense of life satisfaction, regardless of whatever genetic set point we bring into this world. However, there is some evidence that those who try too hard to be happy undermine their own efforts. As the old adage goes, the easiest way to make something difficult is to try too hard. In our pursuit of happiness, it's good to pause frequently to just be happy. Essentially, I suspect that the underlying foundation of happiness is built on actually living one's own life. You may have come across research on people close to death where they were asked to reveal their greatest regret in life. That's not a particularly nice question to ask those souls with many regrets, particularly at the end of their lives, but it is one that may help the rest of us avoid a similar fate. Among those who are most regretful, their number one lament was that they had lived someone else's life, a life prescribed for them by other people or by the larger culture. Put another way, we all die, but not all of us truly live. The best chance one has to enjoy a happy and fulfilling existence is to find, understand, and then live in a manner that is true to oneself. Don't live someone else's life. If it's not yours, it won't be a happy one.
Do we have time?
Okay. Your comments and questions are welcome. And if you want to disagree with me, feel free. When I was 14, my mother told me I had an oppositional disorder, and I haven't gotten over it yet, so fire away.
Okay, I'll go first. I'm Barb. And I have made... I'm beginning to experience a transformation of living in forgiveness this last year. And it is changing my life in ways I could never have anticipated. And I would encourage forgiveness for all of us, because it's the person who forgives that benefits the most.
And thank you. And as the research says, that's absolutely true. I think it was the Buddha who said that bitterness is like a hot coal you hold in the grip of your own hand.
This is Lynn. Thanks, Philip. I enjoyed the sermon, and I like your column in the journal, and thanks for
You're
sharing.
The one, huh? Thanks.
And, you know, it's great. It's just a really good reminder of all the things that we should be working on in our lives. We have a meditation here weekly at church, which is awesome. I encourage everyone to go. And I think the forgiveness part is really, it's really a hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. And we had a woman, Elizabeth Lewis, last year. She did the a workshop here on forgiveness, and then she does individual sessions on forgiveness, and you know, again, I encourage anyone to take part in that. It was really powerful, and again, like Barb had said, it's really you who are suffering if you're not able to forgive. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And in reference to your mention of meditation, the research done at the University of Wisconsin, the Center for Investigating Healthy Mind, shows that as little as 12 to 15 minutes of meditation a day is all that is necessary to sustain significant beneficial effects. So we're not talking about sitting in a cave for an hour, you know, every day or something like that.
Hi, I'm Angel. What does the research say about children, no marriage?
That's an excellent question that I don't have an answer for you. So okay. I'm going to go look it up.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, on a serious note, a couple months ago, I woke up feeling very much compelled to find this woman whose actions caused my daughter to be a quadriplegic. Mm-hmm. And I found her with somewhat ease, and she answered the door, and I said, told her, I just want you to know that my daughter forgave you a long time ago. But I haven't until today. Right now, I forgive you. And on the way there, I really didn't give it much thought. Like, this was just what I was supposed to do. I was compelled to do it. Believing, I went, holy shit, what did I just do? But the oddness that I felt in my body and the peace and the lightness after I did that was amazing. And it took nearly 7 years, but I got there, and it's a nice feeling now. It really is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I would be described as by many as living in my brain too much. And
the person next to you is nodding as you say.
Yeah. She would be one of the many. And yet I have this internal conflict with hearing strategies for happiness coming from a research perspective. I mean, you never hear Buddha saying, and everything I'm preaching is research-based. have you ever had this conflict? Can you help me understand how I can see forgiveness as a strategy instead of just something that is a lifestyle? I don't know how to explain what I'm saying, but it's a conflict.
Yeah, the research is helpful in the sense that it informs us, but it really doesn't give us the experience of forgiveness or how to achieve it. And what it does show is that forgiveness is supported largely by ceremony and ritual, things that invoke and connect with the subconscious or intuitive self, which is where the forgiveness comes from. It's not going to come from your prefrontal cortex. And so it's a process that is very much out of your head. Now, you may have to prepare for it by using your intellect, setting up the strategy and so on and so forth, but the actions themselves are what support forgiveness, not the thinking about or planning. And in terms of the whole thing about research, I'm a big proponent of evidence-based things in the behavioral sciences, but I don't believe that research is able to tell us everything. For instance, the Buddha did say, and didn't have any research to back it up, you are what you think, having become what you thought. So he recognized the importance of thought.
I was just curious, I was surprised that you didn't bring up perspective as a contributor to happiness, and I was wondering if there was any comment that you would have on a person's perspective on their own life and how that may affect or you could enhance your own happiness through perspective.
Yeah, I think the only reference I made to that was when I said lose your mind and come to your senses. Because fundamentally, we do know that happiness tends to be undermined by too much navel gazing, if you will, which is that's sort of what we used to call neurosis, and then we threw neurosis out of the DSM-4 or whichever statistical manual of mental disorders, they got rid of that, which really bummed me because I really liked it because I felt like it fit me. A neurotic, what's the definition of neurosis? There's people who are depressed and they're just depressed. But then if you're depressed about being depressed, that's neurotic, okay? So perspective to me is not spending a ton of time sort of analyzing, critiquing, judging yourself, but again, doing what Joseph Campbell said, and that is having an experience of being alive. When you have the experience of being alive, all the perspective just fills in, and it doesn't become such an issue. Having said that, however, I do know that it's helpful for people, and this is where nature interaction comes into play, when they feel like they're closed in their life and they're sort of trapped in their ego and they can't see beyond their own stuff, it's often helpful for them to go out into the natural world in a way that gives them a visual perspective. Look up at the night sky, at the stars, go up on a high place and see the vista, go down to the shore of Lake Michigan and look out over the horizon. Those kind of things help us get a perspective and realize that our drama, while it's important to us, is just one among billions.
My name is Tom.
Hi, Tom.
And this might seem a little tangential, but maybe not. But the you may not know this, but the Ice Age Trail passes about a quarter mile past this church.
Mm-hmm.
And in all winter long, at least, I park down at Hartbrook and walk about a mile along the side of the Park River to church. So it's not a paved, there's some trail there, but it's not plowed. Anyway, I'd like to invite anybody that's interested to do the same.
Well, it comes to me, you're preaching to the choir there. I think the nature interaction is strongly correlated with perspective and with overall life satisfaction.
I'm Michelle, and I think I'm a little torn between the two forgiveness thing. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, in order to forgive, do you have to face your oppressor? Or can you forgive internally without having to see her in order to forgive someone?
I really think that varies from person to person. There are some people who find that they must have some moment with the person that they feel has wronged them. And there are others who feel that that may even be the antithesis of what they need in order to achieve forgiveness, that in fact more of that interaction will make it more difficult. I think you have to listen to your own intuition about that and really do what feels right at that moment, as opposed to some prescription that may be handed out by so-called experts. Hope that helps.
Hi, I'm Anna, and I was wondering, I've had an argument with people about money buying happiness, and I know people who are convinced that if they just make enough money, they're going to be happy, and they argue with me and they tell me that, but you can buy freedom with money, and you can buy time with money, and you can buy, and so I'm just wondering, what can you say to people who, you know, that they're doomed to be unhappy because they just believe that if they make enough, they're going to be happy?
I say good luck. Because, again, I mean, there are people who attain a certain degree of wealth and do have an increase in life satisfaction from that. Actually, not from that, but because it affords them the opportunity to do two primary things: engage in experiences that bring greater life satisfaction, and give to other people, help other people in their lives. People who use money those ways can be happier by virtue of having greater wealth. People who are in poverty are definitely made happier by having more money because they need to be risen to a basic level. But if somebody doesn't get that formula of using wealth for the benefit of others rather than themselves, the more wealth they have, the less happy they will be, and the research bears that out. So I just tell them that and, again, bid them good luck. And I was going to say, don't suffer fools, but, it's probably a little cruel. Okay.
So if you have any more questions or comments, you can join us in that room that way afterwards.
Thank you.
We have extinguished the chalice here that it might glow gently in our hearts. May it light your path as you leave this place. And may it guide your way until we are here again together. Please stand and embody your spirit in singing our closing hymn. And please also remain in the room for the benediction. And the closing hymn is number 354, We Laugh, We Cry, verses 1 and 4.
Thank you.
not be afraid to go out into the world and seek happiness, to find it in the communities we live in, to plant your own seeds of happiness and to watch them grow.
Never.